So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar. This week, I'm joined by our UK bureau chief, Matt Smith. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Devendra. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm surviving. And also, our podcast producer, Ben Ellman, will be chiming in this week. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. Sherlyn is taking a much-needed break because she basically like did several events over the last week. So she's burned out. She's taken a rest. We are going to be diving into some recent news, including the crypto crash. A lot of things have happened around the cryptocurrency industry. Both Luna and Terra USD are two major projects that have just completely tanked and almost taken down the entire industry with them. We'll be diving into that and also some other recent news. Stay tuned for the end of this episode. I have an interview with Tim Miller and Jennifer Yeh Nelson, the folks behind the show Love, Death, and Robots on Netflix. Tim Miller. He's the guy who directed Deadpool and Terminator Dark Fate. I think he's a really talented guy. I think that show is really cool. And we had a great chat about, you know, the future of animation and kind of how they want to prove that animation could be for adults, which is the thing we're still doing in 2022. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's super helpful. And, drop us an email at podcastengadget.com if you have any comments. We also typically do a live stream Thursday mornings around 10 a.m. Eastern. We're not doing that for this episode because our live stream guy's out. He's on vacation as well. But typically, you can find us there. Join us and see us on video. We'll sometimes be showing off products and having Q&As and things like that. So let's dive into what the hell is going on with crypto. And this is a whole thing that started last week, apparently. So a lot of things have happened. Luna and Terra USD, two projects created by Terraform and the really like outspoken entrepreneur Do Kwon, have pretty much tanked, and they've kind of sent shockwaves throughout the crypto world. And let's put it this way. Terra USD was once the third most popular stablecoin, which is, you know, a type of cryptocurrency that's supposed to be not as volatile as everything else. It was tied to the US dollar. Once the most third popular, valued at a peak of nearly $20 billion, now has been reduced to practically nothing. And Terra USD is a really important thing because it's like it's not backed by cash or treasuries or like other assets, as the New York Times describes. It's value is based on an algorithm connected to Luna, which is, if this stuff has started to sound like a Ponzi scheme, you know, over the last few years, I feel like this is the most premier example of it. Joining us to talk about all this is Manda Farrow, co-host and producer of the Virtual Economy podcast. Manda, how's it going?
It's going good. It's going good.
Okay. I feel like you guys at the Virtual Economy podcast think a lot about the business side of video games, and you see more into this world than certainly we do. Honestly, we get news around NFT projects a lot, and I feel like our baseline response now is no NFT shit. Just like
that's
no.
Us too.
Yeah, I cannot deal with your project, which may or may not exist or which may or may not be trying to steal money from people. From your perspective, just broadly, what do you see going on with the crypto world?
Well, I mean, like, I'm not a crypto expert by any stretch of the imagination. But when I took a look at what happened with Terra USD and Luna, and I did a lot of research about this last night just so that I could actually, I don't know, talk about it.
I appreciate you doing homework. It's very
what
helpful.
I do. When I started doing a little bit of digging into what was going on with Terra USD and Luna, what really stood out for me was not even just that this feels like a Ponzi scheme. It was a weird seesaw that felt like it was destined to fall apart. You know, because everybody moved from one side of the seesaw, which was Terra USD, to the other side of the seesaw, which was Luna. And they were burning Luna or burning Terra USD to get more Luna. And it was like the whole reason why it collapsed is because the seesaw doesn't work anymore because the algorithm was broken. So
it's very, so Luna came out in 2018. Terra USD is a more recent thing. But it did seem like a way for them to like, okay, we built this this one digital currency that seems to be doing pretty well. Let's like extend the value another way, I guess, with the stablecoin. Yeah.
I suppose so. It just honestly, even just looking into the way the algorithm was built, it just looked incredibly complicated and probably is a reason why I just don't mess around with cryptocurrency for the most part.
We are not giving you all any investment advice. In fact, I think the best advice anybody can hear right now is don't touch crypto unless you're like ready to lose something. You know, don't put your life savings into it, which is something we've been seeing happening. Like a lot of people
remortgaged
saying, oh my God,
houses.
Yeah,
like, seriously,
my everything is kind of gone. To give you an idea of how bad things have gotten, let's talk about Binance. Binance, you know, is an exchange that invested $3 million in Luna in 2018. They had backed in other ways too. As of last month, that investment was worth up to $1.6 billion. That's billion with a B. Today or this week, it's worth about $2,391.
So they're doing super well.
Yeah.
That's such a
and they're like taking it in strides, it seems, but it's also like they basically just lost $3 million, which I feel like something like this is prepared to. But the idea of losing out on, you know, over $1.5 billion because you didn't cash out at the right time is just like, that's just like something that makes you want to just sit down and think about, you know, your place in the universe. It is just like devastating.
Yeah. And I think that the part of the big reason why we're seeing this big ripple effect with regards to what happened with TerraUSD and Luna is because it was basically like a run on the banks, right? And crypto's never seen a depression the way that the rest of the economy has seen recessions and depressions and everything like that. But think back to what happened during the Great Depression. It was a run on the banks. Everybody was rushing to get their money out because everything was falling apart. Mm-hmm. And what happened in the Great Recession of, you know, 2008, 2009 with the subprime mortgage crisis, you know, that's all stuff that we can kind of see being transposed into crypto right now because everybody was rushing to get their money out because they were noticing these steep dives that they couldn't explain. Because unless you really understand how crypto works, it just is kind of like this magic thing that sometimes makes you money, but other times doesn't.
It is weird how like I remember when Bitcoin, you know, kicked off in like 2009, 2010.
I know, I
hearing
do too.
About this stuff. Yeah, we were here. We were following it and to see like how far things have gotten. Like I think the thing is if you had invested like $1,000 in Bitcoin in 2010, right? It'd be worth quite a lot now. I think over 100 million or something, like some ridiculous amount. Let's talk about like the broader industry too. Bitcoin hit its lowest point last week since 2020. It was worth over $41,000 per coin last month. As of today, it's under $30,000, which is a huge, huge dip. Coinbase also tanked. It's one of the largest cryptocurrency exchanges. It reported a $430 million quarterly loss last week. Its stock has plunged 82%. It's lost more than 2 million active users. Like a lot of stuff. A lot of bad things happening. Amanda, you focus more on like the NFT side of things, especially how it relates to games. Like from your perspective, we've also, you know, heard about some NFT projects coming, and I think a lot of companies have just quietly backed away from them and pretended like those things aren't happening anymore. What are you seeing from the gaming and NFT side of things?
Well, I think since, you know, what happened with Axie Infinity, which is probably the premier, or up until fairly recently, was the premier NFT game, the play-to-earn game.
Can you give us like a, basic, like what went down there?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So back in April, Axie Infinity was hacked and lost, I think it was like $600 million worth of its own value because it went through this huge hack. Now, I don't really know how the hack itself went down, but it definitely became the poster child of this is not nearly as secure as y'all think it is. And NFTs and games are, NFTs just in general, are just losing more and more value, losing more and more in terms of their popularity. I mean, NFTs, like when Anil Dash originally created them, like he really just wanted it to be protection for artists on the internet. You can mint your own artwork.
It was
a little
digital art project. Yeah. Like, I remember him writing about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was such a lovely, benevolent way of looking at, you know, taking control of your own IP on the internet so it doesn't get stolen, mm-hmm. you know, and you have a way to track it. But it's kind of been, it was co-opted by Silicon Valley bros and turned into investments that, and it just was never meant to be that. So
let's tie these together, by the way. So if people don't quite understand what's happening, right? So Bitcoin begat the blockchain. The blockchain is a distributed ledger that, you know, records all the transactions of Bitcoin. The whole idea is that it was supposed to be decentralized. You don't have to rely on a bank. You don't have to rely on like federal protections or anything. And now we're seeing where all that's going.
And it bleeds borders, right? Like, yeah, that was the whole point, is it was supposed to give a decentralized currency on the internet.
Global currency, yeah.
That would allow people around the world to partake in it and not have to worry about, you know, governments regulating it or governments being like, you can't have that or whatever.
And NFTs are the idea that, at least as we know them today, right? They're basically using a blockchain to link records of ownership. Yes. To digital assets, not the assets themselves. I still don't really fathom how all this is going. But the if you research like Anil Dash's stuff, like he wrote about how like, oh my god, I created NFTs and I didn't even realize it.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Because it was during like it was during like a dev jam or something like that. You know, and it was like I said, it was just meant to be this thing that he'd originally intended is just for artists to use to take care of their own stuff. And that's kind of how we've ended up in this position. And, you know, tying it back to what's going on with NFTs and games, you know, we had this run on the industry over the last, you know, I guess 6 to 12 months, where we saw more and more gaming companies, you know, anyone from Team 17, which was a, you know, an indie publisher, to Square Enix, which is an enormous publisher based out of Japan. You know, these are all folks that have said that they're interested in NFTs and games without actually understanding, you know, some of the bigger issues around NFTs and the blockchain, and interoperability is a really big one. You know, we heard from the Forza Horizon 5 devs in putting in, you know, the Halo Warthog into their game, and what a nightmare that was. Can you imagine that for like NFTs in games, where you can take, you know, Master Chief's helmet and go bring it into Fortnite, and the devs have to deal with that somehow. Yeah. They have to figure out how to make all of that work. So
it's
NFTs,
just so easy. Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. Being a developer is easy. Games are easy. You know, they're not difficult at all. So a lot of the stuff that some of these publishers, because it was publishers, it wasn't really developers that were talking about it, but a lot of these publishers were looking at it as an easy way to make money, as like an extension of microtransactions and DLC that we see in games, which
it's not hard. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like loot boxes and stuff like that. That didn't go poorly for the game industry at all. No, definitely not. Those aren't banned in a bunch of countries in Europe. No, let's just see what happens. So, you know, tying that back to like what happened with Axie Infinity and that big hack with the whole play to earn structure, you know, NFTs and games are not nearly as secure as folks wanted them to be. And they're not nearly as easy to implement as, you know, fans of NFTs want them to be either.
Just like sheer magical thinking. Like, guys, imagine if you can have these an item from one game and you could just bring it to another game. Because and the like, magic of NFTs, sure.
It's a cool idea. If you think about it, having in-game collectibles that are just for you.
Sure. Individualized, unique. Yeah.
Totally. Like that kind of seems really neat, right? But when you really think about it, like taking that interoperability and trying to port that into other games, it just doesn't work. Because most developers are already under a time crunch anyway. They're not going to want to take somebody else's work and implement it into their game for no reason. Because it creates this decentralized power structure within the development process where it's the players that have all the power when it's the developers that have all the expertise.
Yep. This is
so it's just a nightmare.
NFTs and games, and also the crypto industry as a whole, has always felt like the elves from South Park, right? Or the gnomes, like just
don't know what step three is.
Profit, basically.
Just profit.
Matt, it's actually any step thoughts two. On this?
Yeah.
Step two is question mark. Step three is profit.
There it is.
Yeah. I was trying to recall Ubisoft's kind of experiments with Ghost Recon Breakpoint. And they say they kind of, the kind of skins you've already had in these kind of games just kind of whipped up into kind of an NFT froth and served to people, and no one was buying it. So like,
no.
One of the ones I've got here is the Wolf Enhanced Pants number 76. They sold one of those NFTs. So for all that effort of even
there's no hunger for it.
It's very unique. It's very unique. It must be worth a lot right now, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the other thing though, right? Is like NFTs inherently don't have any value. It's like like currency in general. It's not worth anything until someone tells you it is. Yeah,
exactly. And you can translate that to, you know, people who are obsessed with sneakers. They are still shoes. You can still buy some very boring shoes. You know, the intrinsic value is based on the audience. And it's funny you mentioned Square Enix, because they seemed so into NFTs for the last year, about a year, maybe longer. And now they've kind of jettisoned a lot of their Western studios.
So they can redouble their efforts on blockchain, on this, NFTs. Exactly. Yeah.
But without really explaining what that will entail, or whether it will be gaming centric or.
Yeah. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense right now, honestly. I mean, we looked at their earnings on our last episode. And again, they're doubling down and talking about all the things that they want to do now that they've sold off their three Western studios. So that's Crystal Dynamics, Eidos Montreal, and Square Enix Montreal, to Embracer Group, which is quickly becoming one of the largest gaming conglomerates in the industry.
Just the Borg of developers. We talked a bit about them. Yeah. It does seem like every time, especially when these gaming companies start talking about NFTs, it is purely magical thinking. Like, I know for a lot of people,
it's greed. Like, you're getting it wrong. It's greed.
It's greed and magical thinking, right? Like it is a gold rush, except nothing for the gold rush. You could be like, okay, I go here. I dig here. Maybe I find some gold. Like you get a thing. Whereas it is still mind boggling to me that they're not even sure what it is, except maybe they're
you can have a copy of an in-game item. Maybe.
It is interesting to see like the crypto industry kind of respond to this too. One of Ethereum's co-founders was basically said, like, why isn't there FDIC protection for this? Like, you idiots have spent the past decade telling us about how awesome and deregulated your entire industry is now.
Isn't that what they wanted?
This is kind of what they wanted. It is interesting though, because I know Binance's founder and a bunch of other companies are talking about ways of basically trying to make the smallest investors whole again, like the people who've lost the most money. So I don't know if that's going to happen.
How can you even figure that out? That's insane. How can you actually derive how much economic strength someone had when they bought the coin?
You can't. Like, I don't know if it'd be. So some of these companies, like Binance, has funds and other things too. So that, investment, the Luna investment, was not their only thing. They can pull in money from other things, but if you want to be totally decentralized, then you have to also decentralize taking care of people after everything collapses. And I don't think too many people are going to do that. So many people are just going to cut and run. Do not forget that Do Kwon, the founder of Luna and TerraUSD, is the guy who's like, what did he say? I don't debate the poor.
I don't debate the poor.
Yeah, on Twitter. So he has spent the past couple of years just being a general, general tech bro, edgelord, like everything. And sure, if you make a thing that ends up being worth tens of billions of dollars out of thin air, then okay.
Gotta love that hubris.
Gotta love it. And he is basically...
Something petard.
something. I think he said he feels bad about the people who've lost money because of his creations now, and he's not really said much else. So things aren't so great. Matt, you were asking, so what does this mean for like normal people in the crypto world? If you were lucky enough and smart enough to either avoid it or to back out, some people have made money. Some people may have made a lot of money because they sold at a high point and they could just like back out of this market or leave in just a little bit. You've been asking, Matt, like, what does this mean for normal people? Manda, just like from your perspective and you like following these markets, any advice for listeners or people interested in getting into the crypto world or NFT world at this point?
I think that the big advice that I would have to give, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but for
we are not giving actual financial advice. This is personal advice. This is life advice.
This is just personal advice.
Lifestyle advice. We're going to call it lifestyle advice.
We'll call this lifestyle advice. Wait. Wait's the big one right now. If you're really, really interested, especially in crypto, like crypto's not dead by any stretch of the imagination. It's not going anywhere. It'll be around. It's going through it's going through a tough spot right now, but wait for cryptocurrency. Get in, you know, if you're confident that the market's going to go back up, and it probably will, get in when it's low. You know, it's a good time to buy in, but
market advice, yeah.
Yeah, just don't put a ton into it. Just see what the market does. If it starts to recover a little bit, put in a little bit more. If you really do believe in it. As for NFTs, just stay away from NFTs.
Don't let friends do NFTs,
especially in video games. You just don't do it. And
that's a reference to anti-drug campaigns for you youngins out there.
Gosh, that's so from such a long time ago, but it's totally true.
It's from the 90s. Yeah.
And I think that the other portion of this is like, for folks that have neither interest in crypto nor in NFTs, I think that, yeah, that definitely fell off a cliff, didn't it?
Yeah, sorry. I'm just, for the benefit of the podcast, I'm showing the graph for Luna, and it literally is almost a vertical line.
A fraction of a cent. Yeah.
But no, I don't want to say this in a joking accent, so people might take it seriously. It's very cheap to buy now, Luna, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's try to compare that graph to 1929. Like, we can't do it on the podcast, but just go and look up the price graph for Luna and the price graph for the general U.S. stock market in 1929 and see how similar they look.
Yep.
It's really going to be quite similar if I had to take a stab at that. But in terms of like folks that might not really care about either, the only thing you need to be paying attention to is the way that crypto responds to this and how perhaps it ties into inflation overall.
Mm-hmm. I think one good takeaway, Ian Bogos, who's a writer I like very much, he writes about games and technology, culture and whatnot. He wrote at The Atlantic a piece that says, "The crypto crash feels amazing." And it's actually, it actually does so tap cheeky into this sort of like, this sort of schadenfreude we're getting from this, because it's also like he talks about like basically pushing his parents away from investing in Netscape in the 90s, which would have made them millionaires if they put in like $10,000 into Netscape. He also like had a chance to do Bitcoin and he just kind of didn't. So he's talking both about that feeling of where I think a lot of people crapping on this tech too kind of feel a bit of jealousy. Like, I hate crypto. Sure, it'd be nice to be a paper millionaire, I guess, or a digital millionaire. I don't feel too badly about that, but some people genuinely feel like, oh man, I missed out on this boat. Like, I could be
all these well millionaires don't deserve life to be millionaires. They just got lucky,
And now it's that criticism plus seeing everything collapse, but also being like, oh my god, thank you, that wasn't me. It's like we need a new German term for kind of this feeling a lot of people are having. Anyway, this is a really good piece. It is kind of cheeky, but it's fun. And I don't think he's being too mean to people who've actually lost a ton of money. And I feel really bad for those folks, because any investment folks, don't throw your life savings into it. Like, be safe.
Cryptocurrencies have always been such a risky idea for an investment. Mm-hmm. It's just so high.
They were never meant to be an investment. Like, that's the thing that people don't seem to remember, like, especially if you don't remember when Bitcoin came out, like, it was originally intended just as a currency, was never intended to be invested in. So it's really strange and weird that it's become something, that crypto's become something that day traders invest in, that stockbrokers invest in, where it was never intended for that. It was just supposed to be a currency.
The finance bros ruin everything, basically. So we got to get them into like green tech, guys. Let's hype up some of that, the stuff that will actually help us, and not like the stuff that is sucking power needlessly from us. That's a thing.
Creating global manufacturing crises, you know, no big deal.
Just a bit. Manda, have you heard about any projects? The NFT, crypto people keep saying like, oh yeah, this coin is not going to hurt the environment as much. You know, we're going to come to a new mining technique that is going to be far more efficient.
I know that Ethereum was saying that
proof of stake in Ethereum. That's they've been talking about that forever.
For years.
Is there actually a good cryptocurrency that you see coming on the horizon or anything, or NFTs or anything like people, you know, something that doesn't have the stink of so much of this industry yet?
I don't even think I can say that with any kind of confidence, unfortunately. Again, because I'm not a crypto expert. As far as NFTs are concerned, especially with regards to gaming, I mean, we'll see what Square Enix does with NFTs and with the blockchain games that they're going to be investing in and starting apparently whole studios around now that they have made some bank on, I mean, from my perspective, not enough bank considering how valuable that IP is, but that's a conversation for another time.
Another time. Okay. Well, I am looking forward to chatting with you about that in the future, Amanda. Where can we find your work? And what else are you working on these days?
You can find my work at virtualeconcast.com. There's writing that Mike and I do. So Mike Futter and I run virtual economy once a week, usually. This week we're doing it twice. Sometimes we do three times a week, depending on how many earnings episodes we have. It's earnings season right now. So that means it's like, I don't know, playoffs in some sport. I'm not sure which sport, finance.
I mean, we also have to deal with that because we do earnings stories too. So it's always a wave of things we all have to deal with it in Gadget as well. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we covered like 12 different companies on our last episode.
I saw
that earnings episode. It was a very lot.
You guys are wild.
Oh, yeah, wow. we go when it comes to that. So yeah, you can find that at virtualeconcast.com. We're also available on all major podcasting platforms. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at Amanda Farrow. And yeah, that's pretty much me right now. I'm doing a bunch of other like secret projects, but I can't really talk about them yet.
Ooh, all right. Intriguing.
All right. Thank you so much, Amanda. Chat with you soon.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to some other news. And hey, Acer has a whole bunch of products coming out this week. They had a product event and they announced some new laptops, some new gaming laptops. I think the most interesting thing we're seeing from them is their Spatial Labs 3D, glasses-free 3D technology, which I demoed back at CES a couple years ago. It is kind of a wild thing to basically look at a screen and have like an object exist in 3D space. It relies on like eye tracking and like actual real-time rendering and stuff to like make that possible. And they used to show it off for just like objects, you know, like people who work in 3D design, like maybe occasionally you'd want to like peer around an object, make it feel as if it was real. Sometimes you'd have to like pop on a VR headset to do that right from a screen. Seems really cool. What they're doing this year, though, is they're bringing this tech to more devices. So last year they announced that the Concept D7, their kind of like high-end fancy premium notebook, is going to be getting that. I don't think that thing was actually released. I'm pinging them for like reviews of that stuff. They announced this week that that Spatial Labs 3D tech is coming to the Helios 300, a special edition laptop that's going to start at $3,400. So a gaming laptop with a screen like this, that's going to be supported by over 50 games, including, let me just look here, including Forza Horizon 5, No Man's Sky, and God of War, no Halo Infinite yet, unfortunately. But you can imagine, like, if you were playing Forza, right, and you could actually feel depth in the screen, you know, like, it's like, actually, you were looking like onto the road, that would be kind of interesting. I would be into playing that. Like, I don't know about you, Matt.
I think we tried to do 3D gaming already. That's what it feels like. It feels a bit like, why is Acer all of a sudden the only person doing this and going really hard as well? Like, so they even unveiled like portable 3D monitors. So like little, you know, they look like a tablet. And these can also reproduce 3D in 4K and kind of, I mean, they look really futuristic. But I do wonder, like, a lot of these are gaming things. I do wonder, like, the serious business use case for them. I'm just not sure exactly how much you'd want that kind of vague 3D feel, even at this kind of resolution, use VR headsets or just 2D images.
All these laptop companies are like, they want to have something special, right?
Yeah.
Like one cool thing they're doing, and Asus has been doing has been like, okay, we're going to put two screens on things. You know, we're going to be really wild about our designs. And Acer, in comparison, I feel like has always been more of a conservative company. You know, like people like their gaming laptops.
They occasionally have some solid things.
Yeah. They have some wild ideas. I reviewed the Predator Triton 900 a couple years ago. That was the one with the like hinge. You know, the screen could like rotate around 360, and it was a complete waste of time. I feel like Acer has some just really wild people in their design section, and the company is just like, okay, let's just try this. I believe Spatial Labs is a company they own. Own. Yeah, it always seemed cool. I mean, the idea of glasses of free 3D is really interesting. It may be 10 years too early for that, but you know, from the demo I saw, it looked fine. I could see it being really cool for games. I feel like the best 3D I've ever seen was like when I was watching the high frame rate versions of Gemini Man and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, like Ang Lee's explorations of that technology, because they were using like 120 FPS video with 3D glasses in 4K. And it just looked like I was looking out of a
window. That's just better representing what our eyes are watching in real life. And so it was scary. So much more sense.
It was genuinely scary, because it was like there are just giants in front of me. Like there's a giant Vin Diesel talking to me in the theater, because there was like no separation between the screen and reality. It was kind of like it felt like I my palms got a little sweaty like how real it was.
So how close were you to a let's jump out of the train, out of the way of the train moment in the theater?
I was sitting like in the first section. I usually sit like really close to the screen, so I was like there. I could see every pore.
I was right next to him.
I was you know, in front of Vin Diesel's face, and we've got more thoughts on Vin Diesel. Unfortunately, helping to destroy the Fast and Furious franchise, but that's a whole other discussion.
I was going to. That's why I wanted to ask, because you know, we've got this other Avatar movie on the way in. Are we going through another wave of like attempts to sell us 3D screens, 3D laptops, 3D?
I don't know. I feel like it's only Acer. It's only Acer, and it's only like a handful of laptops. They're like, guys, here.
Yeah.
Is this going to work? I don't know. It feels a bit like a carnival show. Also, $3,400, the starting price for the gaming laptop. That's way too high. That is like a fully specced out Razer Blade 15 or 17. You know,
you
like
you said already about the delicious joy of watching like these cryptocurrencies tank and not having to invest it. I think a lot of us got the same feeling when we didn't buy 3D TVs.
Well, you know, for a while that was kind of the only thing you could buy, right? Like 3D was there, it was baked into everything.
It was 3D before, or OLED for even more again than the 3D ones, I think. But then the OLED people won, you know, that was
and
the right choice.
And now we're in like a weird spot too, because it's like, I have 3D Blu-rays. I'd love to be able to see more easily.
Yeah.
And my OLED TV supports it. No, it does not support it, but my old projector supported. I have newer projectors that don't support it. Like we're just in a weird quagmire of formats, and Acer is just like, hey guys, more 3D. Let's keep
probably with its own special Acer Movie Vision 3D.x or some janky name for why you need to have an Acer proprietary movie file. Yes, it does happen a lot, but we'll see. Did you see any of these in real life? Did we get someone to actually stare at
it? I have not seen this one in real life. I did get to take a look at the a lesser laptop, like their Acer's new Triton 300 SE, which is a basic 14-inch gaming laptop. It looks good. They make a good gaming laptop, and I feel like over the years, reviews for their devices have also become like more steady. I think in general, people like them more than the Asus gaming laptops. It depends. Build quality is really good. Feels good. Like I feel like you really have to try to go wrong with a gaming laptop these days. So the one I tested also has an OLED screen. You know, it had an RTX 3060 in it. Feels good. Gaming laptops are generally good right now. You probably find some great deals. So yeah, we're going to keep an eye out on all this Acer stuff. I want to test one of these 3D laptops at some point. Maybe the monitor we'll be able to test out first. But we'll see what's up with that. Ben, you want to talk about this story about ICE immigration enforcement, and basically a realization recently. A study found that ICE basically operates a huge surveillance dragnet where they have a lot of identifiable information around people. Can you give us the basics on that?
Okay, yeah, so this is really spooky. Mm-hmm. So this is a report from the Georgetown Law School Center for Privacy and Technology, big fancy university in Washington, D.C. Georgetown Law School, of course, known for pumping out lawyers that eventually, you know, will argue cases at the Supreme Court or become lobbyists, the high-powered folks. This report found out that ICE has just a ton of warrantless access to state and local public records, in addition to private records. Private in the sense of utilities. So when you apply to get a new phone connection, or I guess cable TV connection at your house, they'll be like, oh, Devendra applied for a new connection in Georgia. He must have moved down there, and they automatically update your address. Here are some of the specific data points. ICE has access to driver's license data. That means height, weight, general location, even the color of your eyes for 74% of Americans. And then specifically, they have facial recognition data for 32% of Americans just from their driver's license photo. Now, be aware that this data can be used to identify you in other contexts.
Right.
So if your face is picked up on a security camera or something, they can use the same data that they picked up from your driver's license to identify you in a crowd. Spooky. Spooky. Like I said, with utility companies, they know when you've moved, and ICE has that sort of data on about 3 out of 4 Americans, period. So if you even move inside your city, if you move 4 blocks, when you apply for a cooking gas connection to your new house or apartment, they'll say, oh, you moved, and so now we know exactly where you are. ICE has also contracted with Palantir Technologies, you know, Peter Thiel's big, basically spy company. They had a huge $189 million contract to custom build a platform that makes it easier to link this information from the public data, your driver's license information, to the private sector data, which is, you know, your utilities stuff. Mm-hmm. So one might say that this is just benign information that they might have, that they can look you up if they need to.
Yep.
But the fact that they have this data without a warrant is the scary part. That means that they can go and find it whenever they want. I'm always trying to make the case to someone that the obvious next question is, why should I care about this?
Right.
I'm not doing anything illegal. You might not be doing anything illegal right now, but what if something that you're doing right now, hacktivism, giving money to certain charities or organizations, is made illegal in the future? Then they have your information, don't they?
We kind of talked about this around the sort of like push against Roe and abortion rights in America. Like, one thing we had recommended a couple episodes ago is to use secure communications, guys, because if you're planning to go to an abortion clinic or something, or you need help, in certain states that could be used against you down the line. Like Texas is basically trying to criminalize things. There have been stories I've seen about like, hey, this person basically had a miscarriage and they had to go to Walgreens to get the medication to complete the process of what was happening. And they eventually got pushback from Walgreens, like, are you having an abortion? We can't give you this medication. It's just like a crazy state we're living in. So if people had access to information about this stuff, if somebody wanted to track you down because the state is being vindictive against it, that is downright terrifying. And they'd be able to find you easily with a, identifiable database like this. You know what? This doesn't happen in the U.S. only. Matt, I want to hear what you think, because
I'm surveilling
London. Is well known as like one of the most like
CCTV haven.
Yeah, it's everywhere. You guys are being followed. I don't know if they're being central databases, but yeah.
I guess from my perspective, I think literally how Ben was saying, like, I don't do anything wrong. What's the problem? There is that. You can also request a copy of yours. It's like a well-known thing for like a decade. You can kind of request a copy of any appearances you make in CCTV, that kind of stuff. And that's kind of a well-established thing. I know people use it for when their phones get stolen, that kind of criminality. What I'm to tennis it back to you in that I don't have much expertise on it. What is, if this happened in the UK, there'd be like repercussions. What kind of repercussions can come for this? Is
yeah. Repercussions. You know?
Yeah, that's a very dark laugh for me.
Because I know that, like, they're, from what I can tell, ICE is skirting around all your very weird overlappy systems of federal and state and all that crap you guys love to debate forever. But where does the buck stop?
Well, yeah, and let's keep in mind that ICE was established and really empowered in that really tender time after 9/11 where everyone was like,
A lot of bad decisions were made, yeah.
Yes, in that time. Many mistakes were made in the name of greater national security. So what is going to come of it? I would expect some congressional hearings. I don't know whether or not that's going to go anywhere. But at least some people will be called up before a panel of senators and made to sweat for 3 or 4 afternoons.
This also reminds me of like basically everything Edward Snowden revealed too, in regards to like Spectre and like widespread surveillance the U.S. and other governments have been doing. Like it feels like governments want to do this. They have been doing this. This feels like the most concerted and organized effort to consolidate information around people. It is wild to me how like normal people just don't have really very little awareness of like what's happening around them.
Also, there's these companies with extremely powerful lobbyists,
yeah,
generating these hugely expensive contracts that you know you guys are paying for. Mm-hmm. I know you guys don't like taxes, but you still have to kind of pay them this way.
Pay a lot of taxes, yeah. But,
and it's going to the military industrial complex, baby.
I love it. But I do remember, I probably told this story before, but when I was running like a 1984 reading group post-Trump winning the election. But I was running that group at the Brooklyn Public Library. So that was fun. It was good to talk to people. We were all worried. We're all reading 1984. We're like, okay, guys, let's prepare for this. And nobody among the like 10 to 15 well-read, smart, educated.
They're already like participating in a Brooklyn Public Library reading group.
Nobody was aware of any of the Snowden stuff. And that just made me feel really, really sad. I looked around, everybody was like, guys, you're reading about, you're clearly, you're interested in 1984. You're interested in like how states can abuse their powers. And you just never heard.
The context of real life and the context of a fuzzy Brooklyn public reading circle are two very different things. I have my own limits as to how much of the reality bums me out. I remember when you get like the notifications for very serious news on your phone, it's like exclusive. This, your politician did this very terrible thing, or your prime minister or your president.
You're like, that's a shame.
You're like, blink, blink, and you don't even read it. You kind of log in that terrible headline and go, okay. Mm-hmm.
It just made me feel really sad about like the work we have been doing, like since the Spectre revelations and everything. Like we in Gadget have been writing about like some of those things at other sites. I was writing about it too. People don't care. Like the audience that should care about this, at least in that self-selected group that I was expecting somebody to, no awareness at all. So, okay. I hope something comes of this. I'm glad. Where this is from Guardian, the Guardian reporting based on.
So Guardian reporting based on the Georgetown report, and this is going to be reported in many other outlets in the next week or so.
I hope so. I hope people are aware. Yeah.
Find your favorite outlet. But speaking of government mismanagement, well, why don't you tell us about this thing that's happening at Homeland Security?
Well, real quickly, I was really excited when the Department of Homeland Security, another like post 9/11 invention, right? Like another thing that should not really exist, but did announce that it's going to be having a disinformation governance board to like help combat that idea. They're bringing on Nina Jankowicz, who is like a very, very smart person who's been like dealing with the world of disinformation. And immediately there was like a right-wing effort to basically discount this board, literally like attack level threats against Nina Jankowicz. She ended up resigning from the board. basically before this thing even started. And a lot of people, people internally were saying that, you know, that the Biden administration was not prepared to fight against all the misinformation that was being used to attack the misinformation board. And, that sucks. I'm just having many sighs really here. Did you guys see this news? Like, were you excited by the idea of having an official disinformation board, even if it's from a not so great agency?
I'm going to keep it a buck with you. I did not know this existed until you told me.
There you go.
If I didn't know that it was going to exist, mm-hmm. then I'm not so sad that it doesn't exist in the large scheme. I would like there to be a government agency that keeps track of all of this craziness online, because I think that's really important. I do think that that's actually one thing that individuals have done a very good job of doing, though. Mm-hmm. If you are interested in getting the straight information, a Snopes view of all the craziness going on online, there are four or five people out there that, and, you know, folks who work for Media Matters for America and other nonprofits that do a really good job of this already.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was a statement from Homeland Security, by the way. They were saying, like, there was a lot of criticism that the board would be like policing, language and censoring people. And their statement basically says, the board was intended to ensure coordination across the department's component agencies as they protect Americans from disinformation that threatens the homeland, including
malicious efforts spread by
foreign adversaries, human traffickers, and transnational criminal organizations. The board has been grossly and intentionally mischaracterized. It was never about censorship or policing speech in any matter. It was designed to ensure we fulfill our mission to protect the homeland while protecting core constitutional rights. And some of that does sound gross, but also a lot of that is like, yeah, have you guys realized that misinformation and disinformation has basically ruled?
Have you
politics?
Heard about this place called Russia?
Yeah. Yeah. There's still like a
there's
lot
some
of like,
weird,
debate.
There's some very weird irony that like the head of the board has been taken out by the very thing they're trying to stop happening.
It's sad. It's all very
sad. It's
also sad,
like
so,
weak. Yeah. What a weak showing by the Homeland Security.
We got nothing. We have no way to combat this.
Oh, they made a threat on Reddit. I'm out. Oh.
Okay, guys, I'm done. I'm a little done about dealing with the state of the world. Let's just talk about iPhone stuff. Apple's testing USB-C iPhones.
I will
that's
not
a,
stop talking.
That's a simple story.
Uh-huh. I will not stop talking about USB-C until I have a USB-C port myself.
I mean,
just put it on everything.
We
Jesus.
All will. I actually think who was it? I was when Apple moved to the Lightning connection. I was on CNBC. It was with Lance Ulanoff, who was like editor in chief of PC Mag at the time, and we were just like talking about Lightning and debating it a little bit and. Mm. At the time, I was like, guys, USB, we knew what USB-C was. It was on some devices. We were like, Apple should just go there right now. And I believe the pushback, like Lance didn't think it was a huge deal. And a lot of people don't think it's a huge deal. And that was like 10 years ago. So if it was fine for 10 years, then sure. But now most devices you get use USB-C. Cars are getting USB-C ports put in. Every Android phone kind of relies on it.
I think some buses in London have USB-C. That's like how widespread it is.
It's great.
It's on every... and like the fact that so many Apple products already have USB-C mm-hmm. means there is no excuse.
Yeah.
You're just being selfish and want to make money. Yeah,
iPad
Max.
Airs have USB-C.
Yeah.
So many things. The Apple Watch connection is
and
USB-C.
It's a bit insidious as well because it's still Lightning on things like the mouse... Mm-hmm. The wireless mouse, the wireless keyboard, AirPods, some Beats headphones,
which
were previously micro USB. So it's just
there's no easy way to plug your like my iPhone into a Mac right now. Like I have to use a converting cable.
In your experience as well, Devendra, I've found that Lightning mm-hmm. cable contacts are more likely to give up the ghost compared to USB-C.
It's really finicky. They're really susceptible to dust. And I feel like part of that is because Lightning is a little smaller than USB-C. So if like you lose, if like a little bit of lint or something gets stuck up in those cracks, like you gotta like really.
Yeah, in USB-C as well, it's quite a hard, like all the technical tricky bits are inside. Mm-hmm. Like the outside is quite simple and sturdy. Mm-hmm.
I've never gotten like lint stuck in a USB-C port. It always happens to me on Lightning. Yeah. One thing I learned, if you have this problem, by the way, folks, and if you just like have a Lightning port that's a little like flaky, like you plug in the cable and it kind of pops out, take a toothpick, put it on like one of those like disposable lens wipe thingies. So like the alcohol wipes, use that to fish around rather than using the toothpick by itself, because you could actually harm electronics with that. But that, because if you use those together, you can actually like pull it out. So the Apple Store did that for me once, and I've used it several times. No surprise to hear that Apple may be testing it. I feel like EU legislation is pretty much going to force that to happen, right, Matt?
Yeah, it's on its way. But I swear I wrote about this during my first year of Engadget, which was almost a decade ago. So it's a long time coming. I think back then USB-C was like a distant thing, but it looked like it could be a good candidate for it. That's how long ago it was. But I think for a lot of people as well, like people came across Lightning much sooner than they came across USB-C, just because of like, you know, the iPhone being the iPhone. So it's just, yeah, the USB-C is just a more, it just makes more sense. Let me get rid of a cable.
It's funny, for like the past 5 years, basically the past decade, like if you want to fast charge your iPhone, you have to use the USB-C brick to Lightning cable and everything. And like, it's amazing. Apple never really advertises that capability, but the people in the know, like us and gadget people, like, oh yeah, that's
use a Mac charging brick with an iPhone cable, and it is so fast.
It's so fast, so ridiculously fast. So anyway, we'll be keeping an eye out for that. Let's move on to some news around Engadget. I want to shout out Billy Steele's review of the Sony WH-1000 XM5. These are their noise canceling over ear cans. This is the latest design. It looks more modern than the last few. We have talked about these headphones a lot on the show. So I love the XM3s I reviewed several years ago. The XM4s were like a nice improvement. This one seems like the design is a little cleaner, I think. Like I hear the sound quality is better and better ANC. They don't fold. And to me, that could be a problem. Because if you're traveling with big cans like these, like, you got to fit things into your book bag.
I think that's a use case that's not that broad. I understand it. And like, you know, Engadget editors have these are the ones, you know, this is the chosen one when it comes to active noise cancellation headphone cans. You get the WH-1000 XMs. But yeah, like better in every way, but even more expensive. But quite compelling. Like, I haven't had cans for a while, but I've been planning to get the next Sony's in this form factor, so there's no
you don't care about not being able to flip down like the ear.
I'm not sure if I can use the P word on this, but you can bleep me. I'll just be the prick that wears them around his neck all day.
You can use the P word, and I mean, that's fine. That's one thing you could do too. I hear the buds don't fold in like before. They used to like fold against your chest when you wear them around your ears. Now they can only fold like they only flip that out.
Right.
So you have the drivers and everything exposed. That's just one thing, because I've talked to people who really want headphones like these, but if they're traveling these days, having a giant case in your book bag like just isn't worth it. I have traveled all around the world with the XM3s, and even that case is pretty big, but it's more compact than the XM5. So they're going to keep
selling.
At the
same time, the fact that the 5s are coming out means the 4s will be cheaper than ever.
The 4s will be cheaper. They're keeping the 4s around as well. Yeah. So they're going to basically have two lines. The 4s still fold and sound great. Like, we really like the 4s. So if you want to save a bit of money, get the XM4s. If you want to save a lot of money, like, look for refurbs. I would say go for the 4s over the XM3s, because those can connect to multiple devices more easily than the 3s did. So the 3s have been kind of finicky in that regard. But yeah, we love these headphones. Check out Billy's review of that. Matt, did you want to talk about air fryers?
I want to talk air fryers, because I had to try air fryers for a long time.
Yeah, baby.
Bloody story on air fryers. So what would you like to know about air fryers? What can I fry?
Which fry's good? Which tastes best? You looked at, I see Ninja, Kusori, the Instant one.
And I also got one of the Philips ones. So the Philips are the first company to kind of make a pod out of it and kind of make it a vaguely sexy gadget. Like, it's kind of Philips' fault we're dealing with all these air fryers right now. And yeah, like, I still have the Ninja, it's a Ninja Foodie. It's a kind of a dual air fryer. So you have two different drawers, which means you can kind of cook a protein with a carb or veggies.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
And
that's quite nice. Have a whole chicken on one side. And
yeah, just saw it in half. Yeah. Although, like, despite the size of the thing, and it looks like, do you remember like fax printer scanner combis where the top goes?
Yeah, it looks like a multifunction printer. Yeah.
It's that's the energy it's putting out. But the it's very intuitive. The dial kind of flips between the modes. So you can set one to go, set the other one to go on a timer, adjust mm-hmm. the timing, adjust the temperature.
It's not that expensive. It's only $230. It's not bad.
And they're getting cheaper and cheaper. And like the cheapest ones, I think Circle, like the Cossary is like a well-regarded cheap one. And you get, mm-hmm. if you just live like just one or two of you and you have mm-hmm. a small kitchen workspace, which I think are crucial kind of buying mm-hmm. factors with this, get the Cossary one and you'll have a thing that you don't have to heat up an oven for.
Do you use these regularly? Like, were you using them before you were doing this?
No, so this was, so yeah, I got them. I was tempted by them, so then I decided to mm-hmm. use work to try them.
Let's try them all. Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, I don't really fry that much food. I have an oven already, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've heard, but we have our own cost of living crisis here in the UK, especially energy bills. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of other factor to it in that these use so much less energy, especially mm-hmm. if you're using gas powered, like cooking devices mm-hmm. and stuff. Like, this is in the UK, this is already so much cheaper if you're going to use these. It's a smaller space to heat up. It's much more energy efficient. And yeah, like discovering really good like things to cook in them, like gyoza. Just get one mm-hmm. of those olive oil sprays, a little spritz of that, frozen gyoza.
Froze up, yeah.
Done in minutes, and it is quick. I still haven't got it down for things like chicken and fish. You have to just be a bit more meticulous about checking temperature. You could always get a meat thermometer and that.
Have you compared them to like the good toaster ovens?
So there's some really fantastic ones that also have a kind of high convection mode, which
is kind of where I am right now. Like, I have a Breville, like really nice convection Breville toaster oven. I use that thing every day because
it can cook everything.
It can bake everything. It's less, and I don't have to like heat up my whole gas stove and everything. So hey folks, if you want to cook more for yourself, any of these things would be great. It doesn't do like the super fast heating that the air fryers can do. We also got the we got the lid for the Instant Pot that can do that. So
this is the more dedicating instant.
Yeah, these
air fryer,
these are the full ones.
Oh, you've got the lid.
I have yourself. The lid. I have the lid for an Instant Pot that also does air frying. I don't like how loud it is. It is very loud. It is like a very intense thing happening. but hey, there are a lot of great cooking gadgets out there. I think we'll probably do a toaster oven thing at some point. If you're buying a toaster oven, folks, make sure it's convection, because convection, it's just a fan that recirculates heat, but that is the pure magic behind.
So many of the air fryers are just convection ovens, just done.
That's all they are.
At higher mm-hmm. capacity, higher aggression.
But I do accept the fact that, they're angry convection ovens that cook really fast. Like, I think of like the Back to the Future 2 scene where they're like just making pizza really quickly and stuff. Air fryers, a good convection oven, those are like the closest things we have to that right now. And I have to feed a toddler. I'm soon going to have to feed, another, like I'm going to have to feed, make food for a baby and a toddler and my wife and like our whole family. So this thing has been super, super helpful. But yeah, thank you.
It's
Matt,
so quick. It's so, like my major kind of discovery from them was just how incredibly quick they can cook things.
I know you're a healthy eater too, right? So this is better than frying.
Yeah, I try to be. Like, I don't eat fries that much. Like, I always have some in my freezer. But yeah, again, incredibly good at cooking fries. But we all know that that's literally why air fryers are a hit. It's because people like eating fries.
And so many things. Like, fry all the things. I mean, I feel like it's America. It's just America's love of frying that's doing it. And also, actually frying things is terrifying and scary.
You're going to burn yourself.
I don't want a pot of oil.
Your home is going to stink forever.
It's going to stink.
You have to get rid of the oil.
Yeah. You got to do everything. I did one of the first things we did when we moved into this house is like put in like an actual range fan that exhausts, and that has made cooking and cooking curry and everything all so much better. Just real quick, I'm going to be reviewing the Acer Predator Triton 500 SE. It's a cool looking gaming laptop. It's a 15 incher. Don't have much to say on it yet. It looks very nice. As we've said, Acer has been making good stuff. Matt, what are you doing?
Hey, so I'm wrapping up a few stories that I've already talked about on the podcast before, so I don't want to mention them again because it makes me look lazy. I'm not. but one of the things that is coming...
You're very busy, Matt.
I'm so busy all the time.
Let's make it so
time.
Clear.
But one thing that's coming around is actually getting back on the saddle for e-bikes. So there's a few interesting ones coming up. I'm really intrigued in these ones that kind of offer a service for you to track the bike if in case it gets stolen. These cost a premium, though. It is, again, the curse of the subscription service. But in cities like New York, London, San Francisco, like my biggest fear is it getting stolen for
sure. So you rent the bike and it includes like tracking?
So you buy for the bike, you buy the bike, and then I think there is ones that do that as well. But you buy the e-bike and then pay I can't recall off the top of my head, but yeah, a nominal fee each month, and then they literally
like
OnStar have bike hunters
for your bike, basically.
Yeah. I think the New York Times did a story on it. We should probably do something similar ourselves. But yeah, New York Times had a story where I think they followed a gang of bike hunters from like Van Move for one of the other major ones. But yeah, so I'm looking to get maybe a cowboy e-bike in. They've got they're on series 4 at the moment. Again, more efficient, more stylish. They're always getting better and better, lighter. And yeah, it feels like a great time to have an e-bike, to be honest. Like we all want to, we're all still planning to escape our houses.
Do you have a normal bike, Matt?
I did. And then I didn't use it because I didn't want it to get stolen again. Yeah. Going back to the original point.
I feel like in any city. It's
so
like,
an e-bike is better for that. The more expensive battery powered.
Well, no, because I have my bike hunters. Bike hunters, capital B, capital H. Yeah.
capital H.
Capital H. All right, let's move on to our picks for the week. I just really want to quickly shout out Belle, the new movie from Mamoru Hosoda. I reviewed this over at the Filmcast in our After Dark episode. I thought it was pretty good. It's not a perfect movie. I think Hosoda, I'm still like, I've liked his movies. I think Summer Wars is still his best movie. I've been following this guy since Digimon. You know, since Digimon, the movie, he is a really interesting guy when it comes to like representing the digital world. And Belle is sort of like a modern slash metaverse look at Beauty and the Beast. It's sort of like a retelling Beauty and the Beast in that respect. It's beautiful. It's a great film with some great like J-pop songs. I feel like it collapses under the weight of his melodrama by the end. Have you seen this, Matt?
I haven't. No, it's actually, there's been a kind of an anime festival, and it's the main it's the tentpole film for it.
See it in a theater if you can, because it's a gorgeous film. They actually brought in like Hosoda worked together with like an Irish animation studio. So like he's bringing in different styles. Like the architecture of this metaverse looks really cool too. He worked with like an actual architect from I think America. And Belle herself, Belle is like a Disney designer, you know, designed the actual character. So there's like a lot of like interesting collaboration going on here. Overall, it's about a girl who's going through a lot and finds herself in the digital world. I think it was really cool. I just wish, it has some issues. So not a perfect film. Matt, what are you up to?
So late to the party, I finally saw Everything Everywhere.
Woo!
All the Time, or whatever it is.
All at once.
And it was so good. I knew I was going to love it, and it kind of totally delivered. There's so many, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's so fun, and it veers in so many directions so often that there's a bit of like whiplash to it all, but I was totally up for it. I don't think Michelle Yeoh can just make any step wrong, to be honest. When I grow up, I want to be Michelle Yeoh. Absolutely incredible film. So this is kind of indicative of this, like, it's a wider launch now. It's been in the US for, wasn't it March it came out?
Mm-hmm. It's been here for a while.
It's tricky because A24, which is the production company, they, in the UK at least, they do need help to distribute it here, which I think is true of a lot of other countries. But hopefully if there's enough interest at this early kind of launch week, they hopefully will roll it out wider. According to a lot of the other UK editors at Engadget, it is appearing in their local cinemas, so that's a good sign. But yeah, so much fun. Like, the action's good. There's like, you know, there's emotional beats to it. Davinja's already talked about it once on this podcast.
So like freaking inventive too. Like, just,
yeah,
there's so much
smart
happening.
It's so
once.
Smart in
like,
so many ways.
There's the so much that I want to say about this movie, but I don't feel like I can because
oh my god, the actors they use as well. Like, it's that kid from the Goonies is her husband.
Goonies, yeah.
And
AKA Short Round.
Yeah.
And that terrible Dragon Ball movie, the protagonist, he's in it as well. And oh my god, just yeah, so many incredible, like so well cast, like
but
looks
like,
amazing,
beyond
sounds
the
amazing.
People in the movie, like I want to be able to say so much else about it that I don't feel like I can because one, it might not make sense to someone who hasn't
seen
it.
That's true.
And two, I think that you should go into this movie as blind as possible.
Yeah, just go see
like,
it.
In order to understand it, you might need to know that it's a multiverse movie, but other than that, just like let yourself go for the ride.
They explain that this part pretty succinctly as well, which is nice.
I was talking with someone just yesterday about this, and last year was the big Hollywood push of like, let's get people back to the movies. You know, maybe James Bond was going to get people back to the movies. Other big, loud huge properties would get people back into cinema.
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man. I think that this movie is really the sort of thing that you should go to the movies for the first time in 2 years if you haven't been to the movies since the pandemic. See this in a theater. It needs to be slightly overwhelming. You need to be enveloped by this in order to truly get it.
Yep. It's also the box office returns for this movie have been like astonishing. Like for a small indie movie, like it has barely dipped since it's been released in America.
So wow,
that's a sign,
that's
like
great.
It's getting good word of mouth. Like people keep going back. I would, if I had time, I would love to go back and see it again. Right now I'm just waiting for it to hit VOD so I can watch it with my wife. But yeah, incredible film. I'm glad you liked it, Matt. And yeah, everybody out there, be sure to check it out. Anything else you want to mention, Matt?
What else am I loving at the moment? Nothing that I'm loving. I did want to mention, we're going to kind of circle back to this, but celebrities are suddenly silent on NFTs and crypto, which is Kel Supri.
You mean all the celebrities that were paid to promote crypto don't actually?
All so your heroes.
So your actual pick is Schadenfreude again.
Again!
Uh-huh. Again. That's just Matt. Matt Schadenfreude Smith.
Yes.
Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Ellman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter and at the Filmcast podcast at thefilmcast.com. Matt, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at ThatMattSmith. That's Matt with one T. And I'm also a little bit more busy on Instagram, which is just what I said, but take out all the vowels. It was a terrible decision, but I can't reverse it now.
So confusing. You've ruined your brand, Matt. Why did you do that? You can email us at podcastengadget.com. Leave us a review in iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Be sure to stay tuned for our interview with the folks behind Love, Death, and Robots, Tim Miller and Jennifer Yeah Nelson. That's going to be coming up soon. Now let's move on to our discussion with Tim Miller and Jennifer Yeah Nelson, who both work on the show Love, Death, and Robots on Netflix. Tim co-created the show with David Fincher. Jennifer Yeah Nelson has directed some pieces. She did Pop Squad last season, which is incredible. And she helps to lead the rest of the show as well. Now, these are both very, you know, experienced people in Hollywood. Tim had directed the Deadpool movie. He also directed Terminator Dark Fate, which is a very good Terminator movie. Jennifer has done Kung Fu Panda 2 and 3. And, you know, she's done a bunch of work across that entire series. In our interview, we talk about what they're trying to accomplish with the series. You know, Love, Death, and Robots is a very mature spin on animation. So they give us a sense of what that is, you know, some future projects they'd like to work on as well. And we chat about the state of animation in Hollywood as well. It turns out people still look down on animation. They don't think it's mature enough. So check out our discussion and be sure to check out Love, Death, and Robots Season 3. It is dropping today, May 20th. So thank you guys so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast, Tim and Jennifer. My first question for you is, when I try to talk about the show to people, I have a hard time kind of like describing what it is. In a nutshell, how would you guys describe Love, Death, and Robots?
Controlled chaos.
a buffet of adult animation.
A buffet of adult.
Not a like Howard Johnson's buffet, but you know, maybe a Four Seasons buffet kind of
And I mean, I felt that from the first season too. Like, you guys were definitely aiming at something mature. You know, like growing up, I felt like animation had a hard time being taken seriously as a medium. I loved anime as a kid too. I watched Spawn too in the 90s. So it's like, I am fully committed to the idea of animation as a mature medium, but it still seems like culture is kind of getting there. Do you guys think like we've progressed over the past few decades, or are you guys still trying to make that point here with the show?
We've definitely progressed. Everyone that works in animation have been talking about trying to get more adult things done because it's freedom of exploring the whole spectrum of storytelling. You're not trying to do things for a certain age group. And to be able to do that and to be on the same footing as a lot of the live action productions is something that's been a dream for everyone. It's just that the market, like the audiences, or at least we're told the audiences weren't necessarily there, but everyone wanted to do that. I think it takes a show like this to prove that it can't. And that makes the whole business, the whole company, town, basically look around and say, oh, this is a viable thing that people actually want to see. And the more people see it, the more we're allowed to make it.
I also think you can't deny the effect of video games which are essentially, you know, interactive animation. And we've had a whole generation now who have grown up playing adult video games and seeing adult animation essentially through an interactive medium. And I think that makes people a lot more comfortable with storytelling in that format than maybe they were before, when it was strictly the province of Saturday morning.
Gotcha. I remember right after the Oscars this year, Phil Lord and Chris Miller like wrote a great piece about, you know, the industry needs to take this seriously too. Are you guys kind of like aligned with what they're saying, basically? Because I still feel like even when it was introduced at the Oscars, right, it was a little belittled as the Oscar category.
It definitely was something that I think people who don't know as much about animation or aren't fans of animation may just fall back on what is the old perception of it. But really, animation has grown so much and reflects the taste of the people making it and the people that are watching it. It's a generational shift. People demand a certain level of complexity in their story. And so it's not princess movies anymore.
Do you find yourself kicking ass in those academy? Jen's in all these academy meetings, right? Uh-huh.
She's representing. Can't talk about it.
She's representing. Yeah, she should be.
I'm talking about the ship.
She should be kicking ass.
It is funny to see, like, now we are seeing animation shows from people who grew up watching these shows. I've just been recently rewatching. I'm watching the DuckTales reboot that's on Disney XD. From people who clearly love that show, but also has very mature mediums and everything. So I find that fascinating. Love to see that. If there was one like classic series that you guys could reboot, do you have one in mind, like Locked and Loaded as your dream project?
Oh my gosh. Classic series.
Oh man. Johnny Quest was a big one for me.
Ooh,
actually worked on the same show.
Yeah. I did work a little bit on the reboot, but it wasn't the same.
It wasn't
the same as the original. Ultraman was a live action series, although, you know, it had a lot of go motion or whatever they called that sort of men in suits stomping on
motion.
The
future.
That was a huge one for me too.
Well, I used to watch the G.I. Joe cartoons when I was little, and I think that was part of the reason why I wanted to Kill Team Kill.
Oh yeah. I can't wait to see that one.
The cartoons and take it to the next level.
Speed Racer was a big one, mm-hmm. but that one's been done already.
Yeah. It's been done. But also, that movie is basically a cartoon too. So I love it because of that, you know?
Yeah, but can you imagine if you could do it in high-end 3D now? Oh. That'd be pretty.
I would love to see it. Speaking about this show specifically, like what makes a Love, Death, and Robot short? Like, are you guys like aiming for specific themes every season, or is it just whatever is cool to you that pops up?
There is no theme. I think it's a matter of whether it gives you that feeling, that sort of nerd joy. That's mm-hmm. kind of it.
Jen says the feelies.
The feelies.
The theme is there is no theme. But I do like to choose something that you read it and you go, oh, fuck, I want to see this, right? It's got some scope to it. It's got some pathos or some emotion that is meaningful. And you just kind of feel like it would be a good visual story. Every once in a while, somebody brings something that said, oh, what about this? And it's very cerebral and in your head. And those kind of things don't necessarily work. But then you get a story like Very Pulse of the Machine, a survival story of one woman against impossible odds. And then you throw in the science fictional twist and it's just fucking great, you know?
Excellent. And I want to say, talk about feelings. Both of you, I think, made some of my favorite episodes. Like, was it Pop Gen?
Pop Squad.
Incredible. Like, I have a new baby right now, and I'm just thinking about that idea of what we would do as a society. And I can't get the Buried Giant out of my head, too. So both of you guys doing incredible stuff here.
Thank you.
Yeah. I love the, like, swift narrative potential of these shorts. Is there any, like, potential for any of them to become features or become series? Like, is that something that could happen down the line?
I think there's certainly a possibility of it. But right now we're focusing on making sure that each short is the best short it can be. But they do suggest larger worlds, and it really depends on the characters and the stories. And sometimes these authors have already written other stories within these worlds.
Or there's novels, like in The Swarm, there's a Schismatrix novel. In Sunny's Edge, there's the Peter's Night's Dawn trilogy. It comes out of there. So there is larger worlds that these characters and these stories come from, that it would be great to tell someday. I think we love the short form, and that's kind of what the show is, but it really was always meant to be an incubator. And if something strikes a chord with people, we could expand it into something more. We just need a few more days in the week. Jennifer needs to clone herself, and then we'll get on with it.
Some of these shorts take 2.5 years, so.
Yeah.
Last question for you. Are you guys looking at the show as also a way for these studios to try out new things technologically? I know a lot of people are really interested in real-time animation. There are a whole lot of new engines that people are exploring too. Like, is this kind of a testbed for the industry as a whole?
Definitely. For Vaulted Halls Entombed was done in Unreal. And it was done at a point where it was slightly experimental. And so I think it was a back and forth with the engineers, which was amazing that they could actually have that freedom. But
yeah, and it was, as you just suggested, Jerome Chen, who's a VFX supervisor at Sony, did it specifically. He's like, hey, I want to use this to, we want to build a new pipeline in Unreal, and we're going to use this short to do it, which is bold and also painful, but rewarding at the end of the day. And it's a great way to sort of push the technology. I know that we often use projects, we'll focus on a specific thing like the facial animation rigs or improving the mocap workflow or things like that. And I feel like the best artists and technical innovators in the industry take those opportunities to really push it forward. And you can always focus on one thing and make it better. And then everything sort of inches up in quality as you go along.
The tech doesn't replace the art, but the experimentation allows often these studios to sort of find ways of doing things better. So it's freedom for all these different studios to try their own way.
Yeah, don't you think though, at some level, it almost becomes the tech is the art and they somehow mix together?
This is what I'm thinking about, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The best artists can make art with a stick.
It's true, but if you want to tell photorealistic stories, you need a certain level of technology that, I mean, I can see a tech trick sometimes and I just go, holy fuck, that looks amazing. Why? Yeah. It looks so much better than it did before. And it helps the storytelling. I don't know. The reason I fell in love with computer animation was because of that nerdy feeling like I'm working in the future vibe that you get from that particular form of art. But I agree, it's everything.
Well, you know what? I think our time is up. I'd love to chat with you guys longer about this, especially the tech and art angle. So hope to chat again. Thank you so much, Tim and Jennifer.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.